insurance does such great things at an individual level and a societal level. And I think that things like Harvey, Irma, and Maria give the insurance industry a chance to shine.
Welcome to the Insurance Innovators Unscripted, the show dedicated to innovation in the insurance industry. Each episode, you'll get a dose of thought leadership from the industry's top business minds, influencers, innovators, and executive leaders. If you want to transform your corner of the industry and exchange innovative ideas, you need to subscribe to this podcast. Now here's your host, Abel Travis.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Insurance Innovators Unscripted Podcast, where we dedicate our discussion to insurance innovation. Now, you know, today I'm sitting in Accra, Ghana. I'm on vacation, so you can probably hear a lot of the waves and the wind blowing in the background if you can. But, you know, I know that I haven't had an opportunity to get back. I have a lot of emails and a lot of messages that I do need to get back to. And don't worry, I will get back around the 30th when I return from vacation. So what I do want to say, though, is, you know, if you learned anything or if you're getting anything from this podcast, you know, with all of the insurance innovators that are coming to the podcast, just take a moment and just subscribe on whatever platform you're using or visit insuranceinnovators.co and hit the subscribe button there. This episode of the podcast does have a sponsor, and that's Vortex Legal. Innovation in the insurance field is exciting, and Vortex Legal is a unique and proven solution to help improve a company's loss ratio by substantially reducing legal expenses. You know, their nationwide network of local attorneys attend the voluminous and routine and predictable hearings for a flat rate, not an hourly rate. So Vortex Legal's solution works with both staff counsel offices as well as outside law firms. They've saved many carriers millions of dollars. So if you want to learn more, just contact Jonathan Broder at 954-473-2648 or visit vortexlegal.com. Now, my guest today is Paul Carroll. Paul is the Chief Executive Officer of Insurance Thought Leadership, a digital publishing platform that's a catalyst for change in insurance and risk management. Paul is also the co-founder of strategy consulting firm Devil's Advocate, a two-time Pulitzer Prize-nominated reporter, and the co-author of The New Killer App, How Large Companies Can Out-Innovate Startups and Driverless Cars. Trillions are up for grabs, just to say a few. Hey, Paul, you know, it's an honor to have you here on the podcast. Welcome to the podcast.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
You know, so Paul, you know, you are an insurance innovator in the flesh, but, you know, if you don't mind, you know, just talk to me about your background and how you got into the insurance industry and then really got into insurance innovation.
Sure. It's a rather roundabout route. I'm still relatively new to insurance, although I've been involved for 4 years now with Insurance Thought Leadership and with a site we have called Innovators Edge, which tracks insurtech innovators and focuses very much on innovation. My background is really as a journalist. I spent 17 years as a reporter and editor at the Wall Street Journal. I did a whole bunch of different things, but really hit my stride, I suppose, when I started covering the technology world in 1986 in New York. And I tell people that I pretty much have been watching the same movie, just in different companies and different industries, for the 31 years since I started this with the Journal, because the first company I covered was IBM, which really almost imploded because of the PC revolution, which undercut what they were doing in mainframes and mini computers. And then the disruption spread outward from IBM to the rest of the computer industry. And then the internet came along, and pretty soon you had retail and music and my old world of journalism upended, and things have spread out from there. So I left the Journal in 1996. I was recruited out by a consulting firm that had the then radical, now obvious idea that technology should drive strategy and not just be an add-on. In those days, you had all the suits in the executive suite who would do the strategy, and then they'd send somebody off to go buy some computers and write some software. Well, we had the idea that in a lot of ways it ought to be the other way around. So I was a partner at that firm for quite a few years, did a thought leadership magazine, and then left because my progression had sort of gone from covering the technology itself and the companies of the Journal to focusing on the strategic implications while I was at this company called Diamond. And then I moved on to focusing more generally on innovation. So for the last 15 years, almost, I've been doing books and consulting work very much focused on innovation. About 5 years or so ago, the guy I've done most of my writing with for the last 20 years, Chunk Amoy, and I were talking about the areas that had yet to be really disrupted, and decided that we were down to four main areas: government, healthcare, higher education, and insurance. So when I met a fellow named Dave Diaz, who's probably the most connected person I've ever met in my life, to the point that he had LinkedIn cut him off when he hit 30,000 first-degree connections, and he had the background in insurance, had started this site called Insurance Thought Leadership, I thought, okay, I can bring my knowledge of technology and innovation plus my publishing background to this, combine it with Dave's remarkable work ethic and connections and salesmanship, and do this site. So probably a longer answer than you're looking for, but basically I come less from an insurance background than from a technology and innovation background.
I want to dig into, you know, one of the books that you co-authored about innovation, you know, and just knowing that that's where some of your deep expertise lied. You know, so Paul, you know, in the new killer app, you and your co-author debunked the theory that, you know, small and agile organizations are going to win the race. And, you know, and that if an organization is big but can also be agile, that then they'll beat anyone, even the smaller companies. So, you know, just talk to me about how you all came up with this hypothesis.
Sure. I certainly was involved in covering innovators in the computer industry. I was based in the San Francisco Bureau of the Journal for a while and was involved in covering venture capital in Silicon Valley. And those are the great stories. But it seemed to us that, especially now that we've watched this movie a few times and we've seen some of the startups come along and upend things, the big guys should be on notice. They should realize that they have to react. They can't just hold off. You know, back in the late 90s, I wound up in the office of the CEO of Sears and was trying to convince him that the internet was going to really disrupt his business. And he said, nah, we're fine. And of course, Sears is not fine. Chunk and I were trying to convince him that what Sears really ought to do was move into sort of home repair rather than just focusing on the retail sales that they were doing in department stores. And I still think it would have been a great idea to sort of become the nation's repairman. But anyway, people have seen Sears fall apart, Kodak, and so forth. So they don't have the excuse anymore of being surprised by what digital disruption can do. And the big guys have all the advantages. They have the money, they have the customers, they have the data, which some people will tell you is the new oil, the really valuable commodity in the world. They have basically just all the insights and all the connections. So there's no excuse for them not to figure out how to innovate better than they have historically, and in some cases maybe absorb some of the technology, absorb some of the companies that are being started up, but should be the ones who triumph rather than being pushed to the wayside.
I want to, just talk about this because, you know, at one point you also say that large companies can innovate, and you say that they, you know, they must do a few things. You know, one of the things is think big. The other thing is start small. And then one of the last things, you know, under that was learn fast. Now, you know, in this world today, a company that does this really well is Apple. You know, and if you go back 8 or 9 years ago before the iPhone, what they did was disrupt a company like BlackBerry, who you see where BlackBerry is now. They're leveraging technology of Google and some of the other companies. The way that they did that was through creating technology that created, you know, a full ecosystem for its users, but then for others to utilize and capitalize on as well. What can the insurance industry learn by applying that thought process to the industry?
Well, we'd all love to be Apple. They seem to be headed toward a $1 trillion validation or market capitalization here before too long. And that's actually an interesting one. I go back to the fairly early days of Apple and Steve Jobs and so forth, and remember a time when the Wall Street Journal was running stories about how Sun Microsystems was negotiating to buy Apple because Apple was a failing business. So it's remarkable what a turnaround a company can have. Of course, there aren't too many geniuses like Steve Jobs around, so it's unrealistic for everybody to think they can mimic that success. To your broader point, yes, the goal for a company that's trying to innovate needs to be to think big, start small, and learn fast. And that may seem glib or even a little bit obvious, but in fact, most companies think small. They're just thinking about what they did last year and they want to do a little better. They're thinking about what competitors are doing. They want to do a little better. Some maybe understand at this point that insurers aren't just being held to insurance standards anymore, right? Everybody's seen what Amazon can do in terms of one-click shopping and understand that insurance policies probably can no longer be 970 pieces of paper that everybody has to initial and sign and so forth. There have to be ways to streamline the process. But I would say, based on what I've seen, a lot of insurance companies are still thinking quite small. Then the next problem is that most companies, once they come up with a plan, start big. They decide that they're going to do something in some huge way, and they study it for a long time, and they invest a whole bunch of money in one idea, and when it doesn't quite work out, they're in trouble. In fact, as we lay out in the book, there are a whole bunch of ways that you can do incremental testing based on a fairly small portfolio of ideas. You see some of these companies that say they've got an inbox or a suggestion box, and they're going to try thousands of ideas. Well, that really doesn't work, because the only innovation that's really going to matter is something that's going to mark a fundamental change in the direction of the company and maybe even the industry. And that can only happen if the CEO is behind it. And the CEO only has so many hours in his or her day, in his or her week, and can thus only spend time on maybe 4, 5, 6 major initiatives. And anything that doesn't have the CEO's backing is going to languish. Then the final thing is learning fast, because you have to not only start a lot of these projects, but you have to treat them as learning exercises, not necessarily as some sort of a pilot that's going to lead all the way to a product. And you have to be able to kill them quickly. The analogy we use in there is something that I learned from my younger brother. Both my brothers were professional poker players for a while. And in my family, once you stake out territory, everybody else kind of stays away. So I never played much poker. But when I got invited to play in a local poker game, my younger brother told me that the most important thing is to fold quickly. Most people, he said, will look at their down cards in Texas Hold'em and decide, well, maybe this will turn into something. And he said the best thing you can do is to fold quickly. There actually are lots of parallels between poker and business I've learned over the years, but that one bit of advice has really stuck with me. You have to try a lot of things, but get at them quickly, because otherwise you're going to wind up wasting money.
Just thinking about the folding quickly, I actually liken that analogy to the stock market as well, you know, where, let's say, a lot of individual investors may see a stock crash within their portfolio and then may, you know, think that, oh, you know, it's going to go back up to whatever it was. So they'll hold on to it. And as it just, you know, continuously declines, you know, so, you know, as I see you talk about that concept, I liken it to that. And, you know, what I also think about is, you know, as you were saying, fold quickly. And then, you know, if it's not working, you know, kill it really quickly. I think about the Google moonshots, right? So what something that Google does, and I'm pretty sure you're well aware of this, is they have a moonshot program where they invest in so many different things that could potentially be long-term profit centers. And, you know, if it's something that they don't feel is going to work, they'll kill it really quickly. Now, I think it was earlier this year, you know, Google came out and said they lost more than $1 billion on that moonshot program. program. And, you know, for companies that don't have that sort of financial backing, that could be their doomsday scenario, which is one of the 8 rules of innovation that you lay out, you know, just in terms of embracing that doomsday scenario. You know, so I just wanted to get your thoughts around that. You know, what exactly are your thoughts around, you know, embracing the doomsday scenario, and then why companies must do that?
Sure. So as you say, there are a number of exercises in the new killer apps that we lay out. And I would say that of those, the 3 that have resonated most with people, I can describe fairly quickly. One is, as you say, the doomsday scenario. That's something that people don't typically like to confront, but is really important. And that actually is kind of fun for an executive team. What you do is you get people together, possibly with an outside facilitator, and have people compete basically to come up with a business model that would put their company out of business. So you say, all right, Abel, I'm going to give you all the capital you need. I'm going to leave you with all the knowledge you have. And I want you to come up with a way to put us out of business. What happens then is that if you do this right, people wind up competing basically to show how smart they are. And in the process, they come up with a business model that points out the vulnerabilities of their business, and as a result, provides ways for people to then stop the problems before a competitor spots them and exploits them. So once you've done the doomsday scenario, then you do the flip side, which is what we call a clean sheet of paper. So again, you're doing this without constraints. You're saying, okay, I've got all the money I need. I have all the talent I need. Let me design the perfect form of my business, let's say 5 years out. Could be 3 years, could be 10 years. Often it's 5 years. So then again, you have people competing to say, well, okay, we could move into this business. We could try this. In insurance, it's a fat target because there are so many inefficiencies that if you were to just sort of say, well, okay, forget the paper, I'm going to design this as a completely digital process from my customer's phone all the way through my systems and then out the back end to claims and customer service and so forth. So you do the doomsday scenario, then you do the clean sheet of paper. The other sort of trick is one that we've done a lot, including on a big consulting arrangement recently with one of the major car companies. It's something called a future history. So you're kind of taking the information from the doomsday scenario and from the clean sheet of paper, and you're projecting out typically 5 years. So in our case, given my background at the Wall Street Journal, I'll write Wall Street Journal-like front page articles dated 5 years in the future that say X company was a huge success in this endeavor, and this is what led up to it. And then the flip side is X company was a horrible failure, and this is the reason they failed. It helps us to take all those ideas that people have and put them in story form, because people find it much easier to grasp the storyline and just sort of understand the things that have to go right and the things that can go wrong in a way that then lets people start to get pretty serious about exploiting the opportunities and avoiding the pitfalls. So doomsday scenario, then clean sheet of paper, then future histories to memorialize them.
Yeah, you know, I think the future histories is actually pretty interesting, right? Because I think, you know, by doing that, you're creating that narrative, you know, around, you know, what you think is going to cause the organization to either be successful or, you know, potentially, you know, fail and not do well, you know, thinking 5 years down the line and, you know, just thinking or forcing people to think, okay, well, you know, from now in between that point in time, you know, how can that actually become factual? You know, how can that pattern play out in order to enable, you know, that element of what we just talked about? You know, just one other thing actually on that book, you know, you also mentioned something to the effect of as a part of the rules that, you know, a demo is worth 1,000 pages of business plan. I just want to hear your thoughts around that. You know, I hear that a lot actually, you know, it just in terms of organizations that are going out and wanting to get funding and they have their pitch decks in front of them. But then there are some companies that don't really have much to show in terms of, you know, what the actual product that they offer is. So, you know, just tell me a little bit about your thoughts on, you know, why this is so important for organizations to take on board.
Sure. As just a quick aside, as we were talking, I actually looked up a stock price because it is sort of a coda to what we were saying about future histories. Some companies actually will use these things as sort of a guideline or as a way of revisiting their progress. We did some work 6 or 7 years ago now, actually, at a very large insurance company, a household name, and the CEO was so enchanted with the positive future history that every year he would take it out with his leadership team of, I don't know, the top 100 or 150 people at the company and sort of track how they were doing. And I see it took about a year longer than we had projected, but they are, in fact, within $2 of the stock price that we projected as the huge possible success for them in these future histories we did. So it's kind of funny how people like the positive ones more than they like the negative ones. You know, I don't understand how that could be. So in terms of this demo is worth 1,000 pages of a business plan, I'll acknowledge that we stole that idea from a wonderful fellow named Gordon Bell, who has won every computer industry sort of honor you can possibly imagine. He was the developer of the first mini computer and digital equipment way back when, then became a senior technology advisor or the technology advisor to Bill Gates for a long time. And Gordon just has a wonderful way of looking at things. Back when he was designing mini computers, he used to say that the most reliable part is the one you leave out. And Gordon, in doing a lot of angel investing and some other work with venture capital firms, decided that he didn't really care about the business plan. He wanted to see what the thing looked like. That idea has kind of caught hold because of a book called The Lean Startup that has gotten the idea of the minimally viable product out there. Essentially, the idea is don't tell me about it. Just do some form of it so I can see what it looks like. Along those lines, we had some talks with Amazon at one point about doing some things and learned that their approach is that before they would get into some agreement with a company, they first do a press release to try to imagine what this thing would look like once it was announced. So you forget all the engineering specs, you define something in terms that the layman can understand, and you see if you can come up with something that sounds like it has some sizzle to it. If it does, then you proceed. If it doesn't, then you don't. And that's the sort of discipline that I think needs to be applied when people think about innovation.
And I absolutely think, as I was saying earlier, that that's just an absolute important part of, you know, really being able to show, you know, value in terms of an idea that an organization is hoping to produce, you know. So, but Paul, you know, just let's switch gears, you know, to your book, Driverless Cars. That book was a crowdsourced book, you know, where you and your co-author, you know, took columns and comments and integrated it into the book with your own research. Now, you know, you talk about how driverless cars has broad implications for society, for the economy, and so on. But now, if you think about that and you apply it back to the insurance industry, what are some of those implications as applied to insurance?
Sure, they're potentially enormous. And I will say, when Chunk and I did driverless cars going on 4 years ago, we took what we thought was a wildly aggressive approach to how quickly all this would play out. And at the time, we're just way out there, but now would probably be described as laggards, given how much effort has gone into driverless cars since then. And it looks like driverless cars will happen, at least in some form, quite soon. Waymo, the Google operation, and GM are both talking about having driverless car, or what they sort of refer to as robo-taxis, an Uber-like driverless service available in at least some cities sometime next year. Waymo seems to be talking mostly about Phoenix. GM seems to mostly be talking about San Francisco. But in any case, that will be the start. The technology will be somewhat limited for a while because the cars are so dependent on mapping that you have to geofence these things, keep them in areas that have been thoroughly mapped. There are also some restrictions on speed and a few other things. So the rollout will still be sort of gradual. People seem to be talking about full-on driverless cars that would be able to take you from here to Florida or whatever by 2025-ish. So the implications are that basically, if I'm not driving the car, why do I have to buy the insurance? Why wouldn't the risk, why wouldn't the liability shift to the car manufacturer, conceivably the provider of the software, or conceivably to what people in the industry are referring to as the air traffic control system? Because there will be some sort of a network that will connect all these cars together, even if they're not made by the same manufacturer or running the same software, so that the liability will shift. At the same time, the number of accidents should decline. Google, all along, it's been talking about at least a 90% decline in accidents. That means that we'd go from 35,000 roughly deaths on U.S. highways every year down to, say, 3,500. So that's, you know, 32,000 roughly deaths that aren't going to happen. There are about 2.5 million people who wind up injured in car accidents every year in the U.S. You know, you knock that down to 250,000. So that's more than 2 million people who aren't winding up in emergency rooms. So there are ripple effects just through health insurance, through workers' comp, and even outward from there, because there are all kinds of secondary effects. It's now looking like there will be more cars on the road than Chunk and I thought when we did the book, just because of, well, all kinds of things that are probably too detailed to go into here. But there certainly will be less need for parking space than there was. So things will change in terms of the dynamics downtown if you suddenly have that space that can be converted to other uses. Over time, you'll need fewer police officers because these cars will be programmed not to violate speeding and other traffic laws. So that will be in effect. You'll have fewer people working in jails because you'll have fewer DUIs, because people will just, if they're out drinking, pile into a driverless car and go home, and so forth. So the main thing is the shift in liability, and then probably secondarily the reduction in the number of injuries and deaths. But then things will go on and on from there.
You know, I actually think about all of the different possibilities just in terms of what you were talking about, you know, with the shift in liability and so on. But then I think about a company like Tesla, who is now, you know, beginning to own the life cycle of their product. You know, a couple of weeks ago, you may be aware that they announced a deal with Liberty Mutual. You know, that's going to, I think it's going to turn the insurance industry upside down, actually. You know, so, you know, as you were talking about shifting liability and so on. And, you know, so what Tesla is doing with Insure My Tesla, you know, it really pulled together and it combined, you know, the autopilot, the safety features, the maintenance costs, and so on under the plan, you know, that they now made available in the U.S. And it was a plan, I think, that they originally introduced in the Asian markets. But what Tesla was saying is that, you know, exactly the point that you made, the safety is going to increase, you know, because of the autopilot features. And, you know, as more of these cars come on the road and you know, the technology has the ability to potentially, you know, see and predict whether or not a crash is going to occur. You know, there's so many things that Tesla is betting on. And so they're saying that their technology is, you know, is doing so well and it's going to perform so well that why, you know, should their customers have to pay increased rates for insurance? And what you started to see were, you know, some insurance carriers charge more for Teslas because of that autopilot feature. And Tesla is saying, well, no, that's not the case. You know, so what this tells me, though, is that, you know, the industry, from the auto industry, is really bound for disruption as cars get much more safer, as we were just talking about. And then as, you know, companies like Tesla start to enter and disrupt areas of the entire value chain, not just the development of cars. Elon Musk, I think he calls this insourcing, you know, so I just wanted to get your opinion on this. You know, do you think that, you know, this is going to be an inevitable change in the auto insurance market when you look at that market long term?
Oh, absolutely. And I think Elon Musk is going to disrupt all kinds of things. Our own Iron Man. As you may know, he was the model in a lot of ways for Iron Man, at least as Robert Downey Jr. plays him. So he, yeah, is doing the right thing, I think, in lining up some insurance to compensate his owners for the fact that they're going to be safer on the highway with the autopilot feature. I think that's sort of an interesting example because it shows how, in some ways, we're going to wind up with hybrid models for a while. The tendency in thinking about technology is to think you go from black to white. From on to off. And in fact, that tends not to happen. You know, there actually are more bank tellers today than there were when the ATM was introduced, even though the ATM was supposed to put bank tellers out of business. There's still about 40% as many travel agents as there were 20 years ago when travel agents were supposed to all disappear. And in this case, with Tesla, the autopilot only works on the highway, because that's easy driving with all sorts of pedestrians to worry about and parked cars and kids running out into the street and stoplights and so forth. So there the driver takes over as sort of the takeoff and landing person, and the autopilot handles the driving on highways. So and these things will be phased in over time. But yes, I think that the auto insurance industry, at least in the short term, is going to have to get a lot smarter about pricing risk, and it's going to have to be a lot better at taking advantage of things like autopilot, but also all the telematics features that have been available for going on 20 years now in a lot of cars, or at least have been available to cars, and that really have not been used, because you can learn an awful lot and be an awful lot smarter if you understand how a car is being used, when it's being used, where it's being used, and so forth.
So, Paul, I want to talk about one of the articles that you wrote recently, and it had to do specifically with InsurTechs and InsurTechs being tested because of the soundness of some of the major storms that occurred, you know, just given the magnitude of the storms that we faced, like Harvey. What you mentioned was, you know, things are going to be moving more quickly, you know, with things like using drones, either to, you know, get an assessment of what's happening, to the gig economy with the efficiency that, you know, that provides, you know, with companies like WeGoLook using their, you know, lookers, I guess is sort of what they call them, to go out and either adjust or take pictures or whatever it may be for, you know, some of these things during the adjustment process. You know, so what I wanted to ask you was, since that article, you know, and since Harvey and the trifecta of storms, I guess, that hit the U.S., what have you seen play out, you know, with how these insurtechs are coming in and assisting in responding to, you know, these large magnitude storms and things that are impacting the insurance industry?
So I actually haven't heard a lot yet in terms of feedback. I should probably check in with Robin Smith at WeGoLook, who's a pal of Insurance Thought Leadership and has been deploying lots of people there. I guess from what I've read, it certainly seems like drones are being used pretty effectively. But it still is such a huge issue that the things are still kind of being sorted out. A point I was trying to make there was partly that this is the real test, and people need to be more like J.J. Watt, who was being so philanthropic, and less like Joel Osteen, the pastor of a megachurch down there, who was dinged because he kept the doors of his church shut for a long time, even though it seemed like it would be a good spot for people to take refuge. And I think that this is one of these stories that really ought to be a great thing for insurance. As a relative outsider, it struck me how apologetic a lot of people are about being in insurance. There aren't a lot of people I meet who say that they aspired from a young age to be involved in insurance, and yet insurance does such great things at an individual level and a societal level. And I think that things like Harvey, Irma, and Maria give the insurance industry a chance to shine. And I wish people would focus more on that. And then once people do great things, would work on sort of getting the story out, because I think that insurance is shifting in a lot of ways. I think it's getting away from, I hope, focusing so much on product, and it's focusing more on prevention. So we're actually out there helping people make their lives better, and then helping them make their lives whole when problems happen. And I think that these hurricanes are and the aftermath are a great opportunity for insurance companies to shine.
I absolutely agree with that. You know, hurricanes actually, you know, I think large catastrophes as well, just in general, is, you know, an opportunity for a lot of these insurance companies, to your point, you know, to shine and show that that they're focused, you know, more on really helping to do what they're really there to do. And that's the to help make people whole after a claim, you know, especially during the adjusting process. For me, you know, as I look at the insurance industry and specifically incumbent insurers, you know, I feel like, to your point, while we would hope that the industry is going to, you know, to do what's needed, you know, just in terms of paying claims and you know, the adjusting process, I feel like there's so many other opportunities as well, just throughout the entire value chain, to, you know, to really, you know, do things very well. But, you know, I feel like there are some of those carriers that just may be missing the boat, you know, just in terms of adopting some of these new things that's going to help them, you know, get to a point of really being able to partner or to serve the needs of their customers. And that, you know, one day they may just, you know, wake up and realize that they might have lost market shares because they were so focused on doing more of the things that got them to where they are today. You know, so, you know, I'd like to, you know, hear from you just in terms of, you know, how you think insurance companies and just incumbent companies can embrace a lot of the changes that are coming through in this industry that some of these new entrants are sort of forcing upon the industry.
So the simple answer is to go back to the idea of think big, start small, learn fast. That's actually much more complicated once you really dig into it. There's fellow Alan Kay, who's pretty much described as the father of the personal computer, who I had the pleasure of knowing and occasionally working with off and on for 30 years now, who likes to say that everybody likes change except for the change part. And that's sort of what insurance companies are facing. They understand that the world is changing. They understand that they need to react. And most people really want to change, but behaviors are so embedded, and there's so many things, not only individually, but collectively, that happen in big companies that protect the existing lines of business that have served so well for so long and prevent people from going into the new opportunities that are going to be the future, not the past. So there really has to be a decision at the CEO level. He or she then needs to bring everybody else on board, and you need to do these sorts of exercises like the doomsday scenario and the clean sheet of paper to start to confront the issues in a way that lets you identify the opportunities and then sort of move from there. But it's a hard process that really requires a lot of consistent attention, and it can't be one of these things sort of done as an offsite and then forgotten about. There has to be real money set aside in every budget by the CEO, and there has to be time on his or her calendar set aside to make this happen. Otherwise, the time and the money get pulled away by other opportunities.
You know, I have to say that, you know, the line that you mentioned in terms of everyone loves the change, but everyone loves change, but change, you know, I find that to be absolutely the case, you know, and what I see a lot, you know, just throughout the industry and just with talking to a lot of people in the insurance industry is that, you know, a part of that change really comes down to, you know, the technology or, you know, the way that insurance companies engage with their customers. But, you know, really when we think about technology, technology, you know, that really has changed the insurance landscape, and it's changed it pretty significantly. You know, so what it leads me to believe is that, you know, we're going to have to really embrace new technology in our industry really to be successful. You know, so personally, I believe that an inhibitor to the transformation is really the inability to shape business models and not innovating because, you know, to the point that you made, you know, companies are so deeply steeped in their current technology and protecting the current lines of business. You know, so that then makes me think, okay, well, what's the industry going to look like 5 years down the line, and what are some of these carriers, you know, that aren't really embracing some of this change a few years down the line going to look like? Is it even going to matter? Or, you know, is it, or are they going to see either a loss in market share, or are they going to see change in other elements of what they do? You know, so, Paul, you know, what do you think is really going to be fundamentally different in the insurance industry in terms of what we see today, but maybe, you know, 5 years down the line?
So, another line from Alan Kay, as long as I'm quoting him, is that the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And that's sort of the approach I've tried to take. So if I'm thinking about inventing the future of 5 years from now, what I would do is start from the customer, I imagine, 5 years from now, and work backward. The tendency, partly because of what's known as anchoring bias, is to start from the present and work outward. And if all you're doing is thinking about redoing your legacy systems, you're going to be limited. If you're thinking about improving today's products, you're going to be limited. If you're thinking within today's constraints based on the lines of business and insurance, you're going to be limited. So what I would do is look at that customer, imagine what his or her mobile phone is going to look like at that point. Imagine what other sorts of services will be available. You know, look at if you're in auto insurance, what the auto world will look like, or whatever. Just sort of imagine the customer and then work backward from that customer's needs to where you are going to have to be in 5 years. So that isn't, you aren't necessarily going to even have all the lines of insurance that you have now. For instance, most of us have several forms of health insurance, right? We have our basic health insurance policy. Maybe there's some long-term care. Maybe there's workers' comp. There's a piece in auto insurance and so forth. And in some cases, there's private insurance, and some people get Medicare or Medicaid. Well, from a personal standpoint, I don't really care who pays for my health care. I just want to be as healthy as I can possibly be. So I think some of the traditional boundaries are going to break down. I can see a lot of ways that life and health insurance would combine because they're both about trying to keep somebody healthy and alive as long as possible. I can see life and some wealth management pieces combining because life insurance in a lot of cases is part of estate planning or financial planning in general. And for somebody who owns a small business, the lines between their business insurance and their personal insurance probably can blur. So I would just look at who that customer might be 5 years out and think in all ways, in terms of the technology, in terms of the service, in terms of reducing the really high expense ratio that insurance companies have. I just, as a quick side note, was interested to hear my former partner Andrew Robinson on your recent podcast talking about how only 60 cents of every dollar winds up going back to customers in terms of claims payments, and the rest is eaten up by the overhead and profit of insurance companies, which, as he said, is just way too high. I digress, but the point is just, you know, look 5 years out, imagine what that person wants, and then work backward without really regard to what your systems are now, what your lines of business officially are now, what your products are now, and just make that customer as happy as possible.
I absolutely agree. I don't think enough insurance carriers focus on the customer. So there's something, there's a statistic out there to the effect of, you know, insurance carriers only touch the customers probably twice a year. You know, one of those times is, you know, when they're paying for their premium. And then the other time, if they touch them the second time, could potentially be when they're paying a claim. You know, so that, to me, that shows not enough engagement in the insurance industry. And then that there's an opportunity to do exactly what you're saying. You know, if you're looking 5 years down the line, or even if you're looking now, you know, just really focus on the customer, think backwards, and try to understand what the customer's needs are. Because to your point, you know, they don't really care how it's paid. They don't really care how they don't care where they get it from, but they do want to know that they're covered in the event that that's needed. You know, so I think that's absolutely great advice, Paul. You know, so just, you know, one of the things, one of the questions that I like to ask, just to bring this home, you know, for the listeners, when we think about these concepts and to make these concepts tangible, you know, how can someone listening to this podcast go back to their desk and then do things differently? You know, what advice would you give them?
Oh, maybe I'll take two shots at that. One is at a sort of high level, and that's that people don't want to buy insurance. Even people in the insurance industry don't want to buy insurance. We all see the value of it, but we don't want to buy insurance. We do want to buy peace of mind. We do want to buy services that will keep us healthier, that'll keep us safer, and so forth. So I think the insurance industry, after 330 years or whatever it's been since Edward Lloyd set up his coffee shop on the wharves of London, needs to finally make the transition from a product focus to a service focus. Forget those factories that are manufacturing insurance products and start working into people's lives to help them be safer and healthier and so forth. So that's at sort of a high level. At a practical level, it just comes back again to this think big, start small, learn fast. You have to do something in line with, if not exactly, the doomsday scenario and clean sheet of paper, so that you can define your vulnerabilities and define your opportunities and then start to put together something that the CEO can really get behind so that you can drive change. Because otherwise, the insurance industry is going to wind up with its share of Kodaks and Blockbusters and Sears and all these other major, major successful companies that nobody ever could have imagined going out of business, but that are either have faded or are rapidly fading.
I think that's great advice. You know, so hey, Paul, I do want to say thank you for taking your time here to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it. You know, with all of the thought leadership that you've not only given myself, but also given, you know, the listeners to this podcast. You know, I guess what I would ask is if people wanted to learn more about you, insurance thought leadership, or, you know, the books that you've written and the articles that you wrote, you know, where should I send them?
Oh, probably the easiest is to insurancethoughtleadership.com. It's a mouthful. It'll give you carpal tunnel the first time you type it, but after that, your browser will recognize it. We publish about 20 articles a week. There are almost 1,000 people who write for us. There are close to 3,300 articles, and my bio and so forth and contact information are there. And then the other thing is for people who really are interested in tracking what's going on in the insurtech world, we have a site called ITLinnovatorsEdge.com, where we're tracking about 2,000 insurtechs around the world, and then have more than 90,000 other companies in this database that are potentially of interest to innovators. So companies in artificial intelligence, blockchain, that kind of stuff. So either ITL Innovators Edge or insurance thought leadership, and you know, people ought to feel free to contact me if I can help in any way.
Great. Well, Paul, I just want to say thank you once again, and you know, I look forward to continuing to following what you're doing within the insurance space.
And that sounds great. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Insurance Innovators Unscripted Podcast. Now, you know, I have a lot of guests and topics that we're going to be discussing on upcoming episodes of the podcast, but if there's anything specific you want to hear about, just shoot me an email at host@insuranceinnovators.co. And on a future episode, we can talk about those topics specifically that you're interested in. So, you know, once again, I do want to say thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.